On Tuesday, April 2nd, at the State AFL Building, 1985, we thought today maybe we'd talk about when Walt started working over in Muskegon and how he got the job and how and why he got involved in the union. When was it?
I started to work at Nord's. Of course, I got out of high school in 1929. I graduated from Muskegon High. And then in 1933, at that time I was working for Kroger's, and I worked for Kroger for a couple of years.
Stock boy? Or?
Just at that time, you waited on customers. It wasn't self-serve places. You waited on customers, stock shelves. In 1933, we was laid off, or before that we were laid off, and my dad wasn't working, and I went in the CC camps in 1934. Wait a minute. I went to CC camp in 1933 and was stationed up at Higgins Lake. Got out of the CCs in 1934, May of 1934, and through a friend of mine who worked at Nord's Refrigerator Machine Division of BorgWarner Corporation, I secured a job at Nord's and May the 22nd. And I went to work on the crating line where we boxed refrigerators. And
was refrigeration what most of people there were doing at that time?
At that time, that's what Nord's made. Nord's made refrigerators. And but they made them from start to finish. For example, you had a steel plant, a porcelain plant, and assembly lines, things of this nature. And I worked in the crating department. There was no union. And then in...
What was work like? Was it large plant? What were conditions
Nord's,
like?
Nord's at that time hired probably 3,000 people. It was a plant that formerly made, Nord's purchased this plant in 1931 and formerly made Alaska ice boxes and stuff. And then 1931, Nord's purchased this plant. It had a reputation of being one of the better places to work. You had choices of working at Nord's or the foundries, or Continental was the other large employer.
Was Nord's the biggest? Or?
No, probably Continental was.
But Nord's was one of the top three.
Nord's is one of the top, the largest in the community. Working conditions were, as we recognize them today, were probably not good, although at that time those of us who had been out of work for some time was quite happy, and the only way you got the job was if you knew somebody that was working there. Yeah, it used to have 300-400 people lined up outside the plant every morning waiting for jobs to put their application in. I had this friend of mine that got me a application, and then when I was out in front of the plant that morning, I got called, and I went to work that day.
How did your friend help you get the job?
He worked there and was a good friend of a foreman at the crating line. And,
so it was because he was a good friend of the foreman?
Yeah, and that's how many people got, or most people probably got jobs in those days, knowing somebody that worked there. We worked, of course, during this time there was I forget what the government program was that come in, We worked 6 hours a day for a while.
National Industrial Recovery Act.
Those where you come in 6 hours a day.
The Blue Eagle Plant?
Blue Eagle Plant with NRA, yeah,
NRA. The
National Recovery Act.
But anyway, which was?
Anyway, we went through the various programs that FDR was successful in installing.
So you were working 6 hours?
We were working 6 hours. I was getting at that time, I think, 37 and a half cents an hour. When I started out, I was 35. And them that we'd work, for example, in the line I happened to be working on, the last operation in the plant for domestic refrigerators, which was the crating line. And so when the line became slack, they used to send us outside, even though it might be only for 30 minutes. We'd punch out and go sit on the curb until the line got stacked so that we didn't have, so we wasn't wasting any time.
But so you weren't being paid.
We didn't get paid for that half hour or an hour that we were outside. And it was too short a time to go home if you lived any distance from the plant. And of course, so most of us just went and sat on the curb or got a cup of coffee or something out at a restaurant across the street.
Were most of you fairly young?
It was a mixed bag, yeah. The same as it would be today, pretty much, I suppose. And because when Norris took over the plant in 31, they took many of the employees that worked for Alaska. Many of those people were retained in the employ of Norris. But we oftentimes was there for 12, 13 hours in a day and got paid for, only actually worked maybe and got paid for 6 or 7 hours during that day. The 8 hour day came in during this period someplace too, where you paid time and a half after 40 hours. Not an 8 hour day, but we worked 8 hours a day. But oftentimes we were there for 11, 12, 13 hours, but only got paid for like 6, 7, or 8 hours. There was an attempt made to organize the union, to organize a union in 1935. It was unsuccessful.
Remember at all anything that happened?
It was a very minimal effort.
Who made the effort?
It started in the, as I recall, in the steel plant. But it was a very minimal effort, didn't go anyplace. There was an association, a company union, in effect.
There was?
Yes.
What did the company union do?
They had representatives in various areas of the plant, and they in turn were supposed to sit down and bargain or discuss problems with the company. Wasn't, as most of them weren't, it wasn't that effective. It was more or less a communication exchange, as I recall it. I never served or was involved in it
mm-hmm.
in any way. Then in 1936, another effort was made to join the union. At that time, I got active in it, or to start a union. I got active in it at that time.
Why'd you get active?
Pardon?
Why did you get active in 36?
Simply because of the conditions. The primary condition that we in the crating line were upset about was this going in and out and not being paid for it, working there for several hours, or away from home for several hours, but not being able to do anything else, but still not getting paid. And then oftentimes why you'd work, like, say, on Monday, then you wouldn't work again the rest of the week. You'd be laid off for the rest of the week, but somebody called your house on Sunday and tell you to come right in. They had some work for you. And so you then have to go in on Sunday, even though you didn't work Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. And you'd go in Sunday, and maybe you'd work Sunday for 3-4 hours, and then go back home again, and come in Tuesday. So it was a very, how often you worked, especially on the crating line, how often you worked was pretty much depending on how the boxes were coming from the assembly line. And
these were the final shipping crates?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You were putting them into
crates? We were putting them into crates, and then they would go on a conveyor out to the warehouse and for shipping.
It all mechanized in terms of?
Had conveyors, but we done the crating by hand with hammers and nails. And
did you have to physically pick the refrigerators up then?
No, the refrigerators come down on a pallet.
Okay.
They come down from on a low rater from the next floor onto the pallet, then we're caught on our conveyor, spaced,
mm-hmm.
and to give enough room for a couple person to work, a man would stand making the crates,
mm-hmm.
the ends and the top, putting the ends and the top together. He'd put them over the refrigerator, mm-hmm. and then two men would get, one on each side, would nail the bottoms to the pellet, and there'd be a man putting on the backs, and another person would be packing the front and putting some strips so the doors couldn't come open, stuff like that, and then a front would go on.
Okay. So you worked as a crew?
You'd work as a crew, yeah, as it went on down the line. And in 36 we started the an effort was made to start the union. It was primarily because of the conditions of going in and out. Wages were, I think at that time, were somewhere in the neighborhood of 37 cents an hour, 37 and a half cents an hour. We didn't work full weeks, so
mm-hmm.
primarily because of this going in and out thing. There was no benefits of any type. For example, there was no such thing as health insurance. I can recall my first child was born in 1938, and we had no health insurance such as you have today. I recall paying the birth of the child, and in those days your wife stayed in the hospital for 10 days for the birth of a child, and I can recall paying that off at 50 cents a dollar a week, simply because you didn't have the money to pay down cash. And then there was no paid holidays, for example. There was no paid vacations. And of course, retirements were unheard of. Any type of pension plans were unheard of. Things of this nature, which today is accepted as quite normal, and even non-union plants feel that this is part of the wage structure that they have to accept. And those days, it just was none of this in existence. And much of it probably was from the farthest from my mind. I think primarily what we organized for was in those days was the right to sit down and talk, the right to bargain with your employer and with the company over conditions of employment, things, just to know what was happening and to have some type of small voice at least in the conditions under which you worked. The old saying, of course, in those days, well, if you don't like it here, there's plenty more to take your place. And all you had to do was take a look out the window, and you'd see them standing out there. And so this was a successful drive, and we organized.
Before we get into the success, can I just ask a couple more quick questions?
Sure, go ahead.
Were most or all of the employees men?
No, on our line we probably had about three females, but in the in the plant itself, there was a large number of women workers. For example, in the assembly part, it was all light assembly, and there was a lot of women workers. Washing machine department had a lot of women. Stove department, they built refrigerator stoves and washers. Both men and women, and I don't recall what the division was.
Were women as involved, more involved than the men in the organizing group?
No, I think probably at that point it was primarily the men. Some women, of course, got involved mm-hmm. immediately, but I think it was by and large the men that got involved.
Would you guess that it was any particular classifications or ethnic groups of the men that were more involved than others?
No. No, it was pretty much just in the National Labor Relations Act had been passed in 1935. There was seemed to be a crusade at that time of organizing unions. It was people had lost their fear. They now had this law, even though it hadn't been ruled constitutional yet. Most workers didn't. Realized that they knew they had a law now that they could organize, and I think it was just part of the overall thing in Muskegon. Most of the plants at that time were organizing.
Continental was going
Continental
on the same
was
thing.
One of the first ones to organize. In fact, they got a low number. One local 113 of the UAW, I think, is still their number, and it was one of the first plants organized.
Probably in 36, then.
It was probably. It might have even been before that. Mm-hmm. Probably 35, 34.
Were there a lot of organizing meetings going on downtown or any particular place?
Oh yes,
place?
We used a place right across the street from our plant where we used for upstairs over a store building that we used for organizing, but there was a lot of volunteers, people from other plants helped organize, the same as we did after we became organized, helping other plants get organized, hand-building, helping to hand-build, things of this nature.
Do you know if that building in the upstairs is still there?
What that building was? I don't know. I don't recall what it was, but I assume the building is there, but it's been remodeled, of course.
It wasn't an ethnic hall or
anything.
It was a meeting hall.
It was a hall that was upstairs, but I don't recall who had it. Whether I think eventually we rented the whole thing.
What street was it on?
Broadway. There was a union hall downtown on the corner of Terrace and Clay in Muskegon. The North plant was in the Heights. There was a union hall downtown that we used for meetings and so forth. Brunswick, for example, was organized at that time. They had a federal labor union in Brunswick, and the carpenters had a part. You had some craft unions in Muskegon that were organized. For example, the paper mill was organized by crafts. It wasn't all organized, but by crafts. There was certain portions of it organized. And that eventually all organized and on a horizontal basis rather than a vertical basis.
Do you remember that causing problems in the local labor community?
No, there was some problems within the plant mm-hmm. because the crafts were trying to hold on to their jurisdiction, and of course, industrial trade unionism mm-hmm. had become the vogue at that time, and there happened to be more unorganized people in most of these plants than there were organized people.
I was just curious in 36 when your organizing was going on if there was much distinction between CIO and AFL within a community like Muskegon, or it was unionist and people
I think it was,
that weren't unionist?
I think that was probably it more than ever. Although the CIO which was a committee of industrial organizations at that time. The CIO had a, was the ones that everybody was using. I'm not sure when the CIO itself, first was a committee, and then I'm not sure when the committee was, when the AFL gave a charter. John L. Lewis broke away in 41, wasn't it?
38. They went to Congress because they'd been kicked out the previous year.
Yeah, they were kicked out in 37, wasn't it? So when we went in, it was still all under one, with just this committee of mm-hmm. of the CIO that was formed.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, I interrupted. This was a successful drive.
Yeah, yeah. This we never had it. We never went to an election. We got cards signed. We elected stewards for department. I happened to be elected chief steward in my department.
What department? Creating?
I was creating. And one day we decided that, this is before we were recognized, we decided that we'd bring all the, that all the stewards would wear their buttons and start acting as stewards. This is before we had recognition. And so that day we went in with our buttons on. That weekend I was laid off, I've always felt it was because of wearing the button, but it so happened I was, in point of service, I was probably the second youngest person in the department too, and there was two of us laid off that week.
How long were you out?
I was out for about 5 months, four or 5 months. Before I got back into that department, they took a protest in, the union took a protest in, and they did bring me back into another department temporarily. But then after we got recognition, I was brought back into that department.
What were some of the first things that you tried to negotiate a contract right away? Or?
Oh, yes. In fact, we negotiated the first contract in 1937.
Took a year?
Oh, no. I don't recall when when the recognition took place. The recognition could have took place in the early part of 37. And we negotiated a minimal contract of, you know, you had recognition, and they recognized the steward system, and things of this nature.
What do you remember being the biggest thing that you told the members in your department about what you had won?
Recognition, the right to bargain, and that the company was going to have to talk to the stewards, and that we had the grievance procedure, established a grievance procedure. As far as monies, as I recall, we maybe got 2.5 cents. Some departments got 5. A man by the name of Les Washburn, who is the, from Lansing, mm-hmm. former director, and later president of the Allied Industrial Workers, which was called UAWFL in those days.
Not at the time you were.
Not at that time, no, but Les Washburn was the one that came in and helped in the negotiations.
So you organized as UAW?
CIO, AFL. Well, at that time, it was before the CIO was kicked out.
Right.
After they were kicked out, then a fight came up out in the CIO. And this is
what local were you then?
404.
Okay. Go ahead.
And then after we got our first contract, we held the ratification meeting, as I recall, in the ballpark, Marsh Stadium. And And then, of course, there has come the establishment of building really building a union.
Was it an overwhelming ratification at this
time? Oh, yes.
Okay, and then you started building.
And we started building, really building a union in the plant. And it was a one-year contract. And then during the second contract, again, there was a very small wage increase. You made some improvements in contractual language. Through that period, we got some type of vacation. I don't recall exactly what it was. And then came a split in the UAW CIO, and I think it was the end of 38 or 39, you may have these dates down, in which our plant went with Les Washburn, who was on one side of the argument, and our group, the group that was with us, went independent for a while.
Your whole plant went independent?
The whole union. In other words, that segment of the UAW.
Mm-hmm.
That segment of the UAW that split away from the UAW CIO, mm-hmm. or
right.
vice versa. I think primarily the only reason we stayed where we were was because of Les Washburn, and who built up a very good relationship. We went independent for a while, and then affiliated with the AFL again. This was after the CIO had been expelled from the, or suspended from the AFL. And
as the UAW AFL.
And we became, at that point, the UAW AFL.
With Homer Martin as president.
Homer Martin was president, the first president.
No, can I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
You're suggesting that the reason for Muskegon's local 404 was because Les Washburn had been so important,
mm-hmm.
individually in helping to organize the plant.
I think that's primarily
in its
the
first
reason.
Contract.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What were there also other arguments that you think were important, or do you really think it just comes down to that level? And why did Continental do differently?
Continental had, in their vote, they voted to go with the UAW CIO, and I think probably part of that reason was the people that were heading Continental at the time, local union. The arguments that was used in our plant primarily were that, of course, the fight originally developed supposedly over communists and infiltration into the organization. That time was a very, very mixed bag of who was right or who was wrong, or where the union was going to end up, because mm-hmm. you had some officers on one side and some officers on the other side of the union and of the arguments.
Were you involved at all in those arguments within the Muskegon
CIO
Council?
I was in Muskegon. The real fights took place, of course, in the Detroit area.
Mm-hmm.
The real big arguments. And once the auto industry started rolling into the UAW CIO,
mm-hmm.
of course, that left UAW AFL with a very small portion that total membership. Fight here in Lansing took place at the same time, over 182, Les Washburn,
mm-hmm.
Of course, was the one that, one of the originators of Woke 182. That was a amalgamated local union here in the Lansing area, and Motor Wheel, of course, Motor Wheel, Dale Steel, and a bunch of the others stayed with the UAW, AFL, and when the vote came, and Oldsmobile voted to go with the UAW CIO. Olds was part of the group here. I don't know if they were separate or if they were in 182, but I think it was 182, but I'm not sure on that.
But it was the amalgamated, but it was headed.
It was amalgamated here, yes. And then, the vote at Oldsmobile was fairly close.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took a few years to shake down.
Mm-hmm. Now, you don't really think the critical fights were within places like Lansing, certainly not in Muskegon, over whether or not people really were communist or whether or not they were this or that, but whether or not they supported Les Washburn or Homer Martin or...
Yeah, I don't think the question ever come down to supporting Homer Martin. I think the question came down pretty much supporting, like, the regional director, was Les Washburn, who was close to our union.
Mm-hmm.
But and of course the other arguments of who was a commie and who wasn't a commie were used by both sides. Who is a company stooge and who wasn't a company stooge and so forth was used by both sides.
Now, you stopped me very fast that it wasn't people's thoughts about Homer Martin at all.
Homer Martin, I don't think was, they knew who Homer Martin was. To those of us who had heard him speak, he was an evangelistic type of person. He was an excellent orator. But over in Muskegon, as far as people voting for or against staying, of which division they were going to go into, I don't think any of that came because of Homer Martin. I think part of it, I think, if decisions were made on that basis, it was made primarily because of who the representative was and who the director was. And of course, in those days, it was Les Washburn. Ed Donahue was active over in the Muskegon area. People like this.
Can I ask another question? Why do you think Les Washburn decided to go with Martin rather than with all of the other people that went UAW-CIO?
Well, I'm not sure that Les Washburn had any choice. I think they picked up some. I think they made decisions in the board.
Mm-hmm.
And someplace along the line, the board suspended Washburn and five or six other of the officers at that time.
Well, they suspended, if I remember right, and I could look and work in Detroit, Martin had suspended
one
over group. Half of the board,
yes.
Which included,
yeah.
Addison, Mortimer, and others.
Windermere, Mortimer, and Ed Hall.
Ed Hall, right, exactly.
Some of these.
And then they came back and
suspended
Martin,
Washburn, and whomever was supporting in that direction.
But Les had made a choice earlier, apparently, to go with Martin rather than with...
Evidently he had, yes.
Yeah. But that's not something you're familiar
I'm
with.
I'm not familiar
why
with
he did
that.
That.
No. See, I didn't become, I was Stewart, then I got elected to the committee, I think, in 39, I attended the 39 convention. There was two conventions that year,
mm-hmm.
One in Cleveland and one in Detroit, as I recall. And
you attended?
The Detroit one. And then 1941, we had another convention. I don't recall where it was. It's either Cleveland or Cincinnati. I think so, Cincinnati. Because come to think of it, Pearl Harbor was, we were on our way back from that convention when Pearl Harbor and so it was in Cincinnati, and at that time we elected somebody in place of Will Martin for president. I can't. Irv Carey.
C-A-R-E-Y?
C-A-R-E-Y. I'm sure that's who it was.
Is that partly because of the fallout after the Ford plant had gone so overwhelmingly CIO, or other reasons?
It was, well...
Did Martin even run?
Martin didn't run. No.
Okay.
Martin didn't run, no. It was Kerry, and I can't think of who was secretary now.
But Martin didn't run the Air Commission.
He was gone by then, as I recall.
But issues about Lovestoneites and communism
were not... It was all there. Lovestoneites, people were being called Lovestoneites. I'm sure that many people in the area didn't know what the hell it meant, even let alone to be that CPOs, Communist Party oppositionists, things of that. You had all this.
So that was common, but you don't think most of the delegates are local people?
I'm talking about the ones in Norge now.
Mm-hmm.
It may have had some effect in other plants that were older than us, but at that time we had only been organized since 1937.
Was less
the president of our union at that time, a person by the name of Claude Bryce, was very close follower, friend of Les Washburn's. And while an effort had been made for the other side to pick up some votes, the meeting we held right in just called a special meeting of the membership, and they voted overwhelmingly to stay with them. UAW, AFL is, you know.
Do you think it's and the issue of being CIO versus AFL also was not really the issue?
No, it's primarily of who we were, what group we were going to stay with, I guess.
But people didn't sit there and say, well, we should be part of the CIO because
some
of
did.
Lewis
the arguments on the floor, there was some out on the floor. Some got on the floor arguing that we should stay with the CIO because this was a group that to which industrial organization was born and so forth. That it was a much more progressive group of people than the old AFL. That if you went back in the AFL, you'd eventually be structured into trade organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be spread apart again, things of that nature. Those arguments were all used.
Right.
But in spite of those arguments, when it come to the secret ballot vote, the people voted to support the president, which was Claude Bryce.
Now, do you think a similar kind of maybe just Les Washburn himself, or this kind of closeness to somebody who helped you organize, and maybe it is all Les, explains why the AIW was more successful in Lansing, Muskegon, Kalamazoo, along the coast in the different foundries and stuff, but very unsuccessful in Flint and Metro Detroit? Is it?
I think again, it was a predominance of the auto industry in the Detroit area.
and which who had made the decision to go with the CIO, and flipped. Saginaw, for example, in Saginaw, the only plant that, the large plant that remained with the UAW-AFL was Eaton Manufacturing, Eaton Company up there, local 433. But on the western side, there, of course, there wasn't any auto plants to speak of. The two foundries, Lakey Foundry and Campbell and Cannon Foundry, or Lakey Foundry went, Campbell's recognized later, Lakey Foundry and Continental went with the CIO. But we were very successful, and we had a group that got out and started to organize at that time. Les Washburn had built himself a staff of organizers. Claude Bryce, for example, went on the staff. The AFL put some staff people, some organizers into the area, and we was able to organize and maintained a fairly representative group in Region 7, which I'm familiar with, of plants, primarily parts plants and plants other than in the auto industry. Mm-hmm. The auto plant that we retained, of course, was Checker Motor mm-hmm. in Kalamazoo.
Had Les been involved with that?
Les, I'm sure, was down there, but the representative handling that area was a man by the name of Ed Donahue, who later became director of the region. Ed Donahue, Milt Rymel, and it built up, the reps at that time, it built up a relationship with the officers of those unions and helped organize them originally. And people had loyalties to people that helped them organize.
Les became regional director when?
Les, well, he was regional director when I met him. And of course was reelected in 41 after we had gone back into mm-hmm. the AFL. He was reelected in 41 as regional director, and then in 43, I think he became president, was elected president, he and Tony Doriel. Tony Doriel became secretary treasurer, and he became president. Now, I'm not sure if that was 43 or 45. 45 convention I wasn't at. I was in the Army. Pardon?
I could look that up to find out. But
yeah.
What happened to Claude Bryce?
Claude Bryce was a rep for the AFL. He became a rep for the AFL.
Did he run against Les?
Oh, no. Claude never ran, no.
He just was president for mm-hmm. maybe one term.
Who?
Claude Bryce was just president.
He was president of the local union.
Okay.
And then in 1940.
So did Irv Carey, excuse me.
He was president, evidently, just for that short interim between.
Just for 2 years or 4 years.
Yeah, that interim between.
Where was Carey out of?
No
point, you know. Less word he worked.
Real.
He worked at Real. And Ed Donahue?
Eagle Auto Leather Company in Skien, or in Grand Haven.
What's the name of the company?
Eagle Auto Leather Company.
And Tony Doriel?
Tony Doriel was out of Wisconsin. I don't know what plant.
And, he was elected in 43 or 5, whatever it was.
To every year that was, yeah.
Secretary Treasurer? Mm-hmm. Sorry to interrupt you. What kinds of things did happen in your plant during the war?
War, of course, refrigeration. Refrigeration was stopped. building refrigerators. And we started building Army supplies, for example, bottom calls for planes, things of this nature. It was converted to war production. Mm-hmm. We won 2 Army Navy E's, for example, during that time at the Norge plant and the local 404. I had to be president of the union. I became president in 1942.
You went from chief steward to president?
I was on the committee in between.
Mm-hmm.
And in 43, I left the presidency. And went to work full-time for the International Union.
How did you happen to get picked to be a group?
I'd been very active I'd served part-time from 41 to 43, helping negotiate contracts over in some smaller plants that we were picking up. For example, Grand Haven, we were able to organize practically every plant in Grand Haven in the UAW, AFL. And
how were you able to do that?
Both Milt Rymel lived, and Ed Donahue lived in that area. Ed coming out of Eagle, Ottawa. And Eagle, Ottawa was on strike, and Ed was put on the staff while they were on strike. That was a long strike in Eagle, Ottawa. It lasted some 5 years. And then finally, the National Labor Relations Act was ruled constitutional, and the people were ordered back to work and things of this nature. When they organized some of these plants over there, then I was going over on a part-time basis helping negotiate. We negotiate primarily at night after work, and I helped negotiate, and that's how I was selected then to go on full, when he decided, Washburn decided to add another staff person up in that area. He asked me if I'd be interested, that's how come I went to work.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after I went on staff, of course, then I went in the Army, was in the Army until 1946, I guess. Then I went back in the plant in 1946.
Back in the plant?
Yeah, I went back in the plant, worked there maybe 5-6 weeks, and come back out, went back on staff. I wasn't going to go back on the staff when I come out of the Army, because I'd been away from home, the family, and stuff. So I, but after 5-6 weeks, decided to go back.
That was enough of the plant?
At that time, of course, Les wasn't there. Earl Falconer was the director. Earl Falconer had come out of Seal Power in Muskegon. And when Les was elected president, Earl was elected regional director.
Mm-hmm.
And that had to be in 43. Because I was there at the meeting he was elected. And I wasn't at the 45 convention.
So you went to work for Falconer?
And
in 46?
In 46 I went to work for Falconer. Yeah. I had my seniority back on staff, but because you had 90 days to make up your decent mind. And I then I decided to go with the International.
Were you very busy in the strike wave, or was the AIW not as involved in the big strike wave at the end of the war?
We had many strikes during the war. It was converting from war production back to to civilian production. I don't recall them all, but we had our share of them during that time. We had Earl was director then. Shortly after the 47 convention, Earl resigned. And Ed Donahue was then elected as regional director.
Before we leave the war period, I just had a couple questions.
Did
the war cause changes in who worked in Norge in terms of race, ethnic group, or male, female?
During the war, of course, the company had a few blacks that had worked there prior to the war, primarily on the lower level jobs.
What were lower level jobs?
Primarily on custodial jobs. During the war, it brought an abrupt change, of course, because then they did bring in blacks, and there was a lot of females brought in that came into the plant at that time.
Were there changes in the jobs and classifications? Or?
No. At that time, of course, during those years, we had what was called male jobs and female jobs. Mm-hmm. In other words, then they changed it to light and heavy work, and females worked on the light work and the males worked on the heavy work, but you had two pay structures, and the females getting less money. That eventually changed, of course, and we had classifications of jobs.
But not till after the war?
That was after the war.
How did the local react? Was the local affected by more women and more blacks?
There was some arguments. For example, when I was president, I can recall a group of women saying that they wanted separate restrooms from the blacks, and that they were insisting that they wouldn't use it, and that they didn't want to use the same restrooms. I just took the committee, went up, met with the women, told them that it was their choice to make, that the company was not going to build restrooms separately for blacks and whites, number one. Number two, our union believed that integration was proper, and that we would not support any demand such as that. That it was their choice to make. They either used what was there, or they'd have to find other methods of handling their problems.
Did that ever lead to challenges to your presidency? Was it
that? No. Reported it at the membership meetings, and that was the end of it.
What would you guess that Norge went from being less than 5% black to how much?
Gosh, John, I can't
okay.
guess, because
maybe a couple hundred blacks by the middle of the end of the war. Or just trying to get a sense. I'm not sure.
I mean, I guess, but it was.
How about in terms of male female? Went from.
I would think that the male female categories remained about the same, with possibly the females gaining during the war period, because there was a lot of light work jobs that come with war production jobs. Although they over in the stove plant division, the stove plant, they went to building that went to a skilled machinist, which was primarily all male.
Mm-hmm.
And there. They were building stove mount, or they were building gun mounts and turrets. That was pretty much all male.
Did you have an active or none at all ladies auxiliary to 404?
There was a ladies auxiliary comprised of wives of employees.
Wives. Mm-hmm. Okay. But there wasn't anything special for the women created by the women members of the local.
No. They were just part of the local, and we had women stewards, some women officers. Not many women stewards we had.
And you don't
remember? Some of the auxiliary members were also workers in the plant, but okay. But it also afforded an opportunity for wives of workers.
And you don't remember any major demands or issues around child care?
No, not at that time, no.
Okay. And after the war ended, there wasn't a mass exodus of the Rosie the Riveter kind of situation?
Not in Nord. There were in some plants. For example, I can recall Olberg's in Grand Haven, which was a muffler plant that we had organized. And they had no women in that plant prior to the war. And during the war, they hired women. And when the war ended, I can remember the demand immediately coming that all the women get out of the plant.
From your male members, or from?
From the male members, yeah.
Who were in the service.
Mm-hmm.
And how'd the local deal with that?
Of course, the people that were in, it was a very young age group in that plant, and there was a lot of returning vets coming back to that mm-hmm. plant, and as a result, it ended up with just a handful of women left in the plant.
So almost all the women did lose the job.
Mm-hmm.
What was the name of that plant?
Olberg's, Grand Haven. Eventually became AP Parts. It's out of business now, by the way. They closed.
So they were successful, and the region really didn't get that involved.
We didn't get involved in it. Told them that the women, about the only part the region got involved was on the basis of informing them that the women were members of the union and couldn't be gotten rid of outside of the channels of returning veterans. It so happened that the women were the youngest employees, and had some men come back with.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them left.
Mm-hmm. That's also curious. During the war,
Norge didn't have that problem simply because you always had women and men working there ever since it came into being.
What were relations like between AFL and CIO, local unions and labor councils in Muskegon during the war?
We had two labor councils, of course. We had the AFL, and we had, and then the CIO had a labor council also. And the relations were fairly good during the war. For example, I served on, we had a War Manpower Board in Muskegon. I served on it as an AFL mm-hmm. member. I had a CIO member on it, and we got along good. I don't think the relations in Muskegon area was ever had ever deteriorated to a point where we stood taking pot shots at each other. Some other areas of the region why that wasn't true. There were some real battles took place. For example, in Hillsdale, although I'm not familiar what happened, but in Hillsdale, there was a real battle in Hillsdale.
Who would know that story?
Ed Donahue.
What about in other parts of the region where you
Jackson,
worked?
There was some real battles, especially over Clark Equipment Plant in Jackson.
Asgad again?
Asgad, yeah.
Excuse me. Did you support each other? Well, another question. During the war, were there wildcat strikes in Muskegon? In Norge, rather.
Oh, yes. Yes. Not, there was a, for example, local 760. That's, that was another division of Norge. It was a separate plant. They had a wildcat strike in which there was some wildcat strikes in Norge that lasted maybe 3-4 days.
Mm-hmm. What were they over?
They were primarily over, for example, I can recall one being over a discharge of an employee. We didn't have, for example, we didn't have a union security clause in our contract at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But we used to hold, we had a clause in our contract that said that the company would not interfere with the union's right to maintain 100% membership.
Mm-hmm.
And so when somebody didn't join we'd hold card checks periodically outside the plant and didn't allow people in that didn't belong to the union.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes interfered with production. But
because it would take hours for people to get through the card check?
Mm-hmm.
But the company wouldn't go and calling the labor board or...
No, in those cases they didn't, no.
They just wanted you to do
production standards, production standards caused some...
Uh-huh.
Production standard caused some stoppages.
But you don't remember any big issues?
No. Contractually, we had the right to strike after the grievance procedure was exhausted. We had no arbitration.
That's right, you didn't go for that until much later, most AIW. Wasn't used too often, though, was it?
No. And probably the reason it wasn't used too often is that the issues were serious enough, why the company knew that the that would be exercised, could be exercised.
When
so
did
we settled it, no.
When did Norge get arbitration?
That it was after I left. And probably have to be in the 50s, late 50s, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
50s, I would think.
And there was recently an AIW plant that just switched, right?
Just got it. That wouldn't surprise me.
It took the last 4 or 5 years. This thing's almost done. Maybe call it halt.
Fine.
One tape.
Good. It's 11 o'clock.
Oh, excuse my sniffles. I'm okay.
It's
okay to be done with this call. I don't know why I take notes.
Do you know Ed Donahue, by the way?
I've met him once.